Welcome to the Critical Futures Podcast. It's critical because the time is now to conjure the world and communities we want to live and thrive in. But it's also futurity, or the intentional imagining and materializing of liberated futures, where freedom from oppression, trauma, violence, and discrimination are realized. In this series, The Future Of, we chat with experts in various sectors to learn about what they are doing to shift the critical now for a radical new future. I am Dr. Amber Johnson, Executive Director of the Institute for Healing, Justice, and Equity, and I will be your host for this episode. Welcome. Welcome to the Critical Futures Podcast. Today, joining us on the show, we have Scott Emerson, creator of the Revolutionary Masculinity Theory and a wonderful scholar of African-American literature. Scott, thank you so much for joining us for this podcast today on the future of masculinity.
Thank you for having me. I'm really looking forward to this.
Great. So let's just jump right into it. What inspired revolutionary masculinity as a theory and prompted you to write your thesis research on it?
Again, I'm really happy to be on the Critical Futures podcast. It is a very central idea to the work that I'm doing. So, you know, why not? And I also very much appreciate your work and the work of others that have been on the podcast. So I'm just happy to be in this number. So what inspired revolutionary masculinity was sort of my immersion into African-American literature. And while I was, you know, taking a deeper and deeper dive into, in particular, Afrofuturist and Black speculative fiction, I encountered and just developed a deeper appreciation for Octavia Butler, and started to dig into her work. And while I was reading it, just the prophecy that came through in the parable of the sower, with the prophecy of the current socio-political situation that we're enduring right now was really striking to me. But amidst all that, I was just really, you know, again, stricken by the prescience of this main character, Lauren Oya Olamina, and her journaling and sort of means of spirituality that came out of that. And I noticed as I was reading it that it was very insightful. Not only was it insightful in a general spiritual sense, but that it also gave some really important lessons that I had encountered in my own, you know, journey of, you know, into manhood and through manhood, about being flexible and adaptable, about using my privilege to fight for, you know, positive, radical and revolutionary change, to, you know, oppose sort of very rigid and nationalist notions of religion. And that religion seemed to embody sort of those same principles. And so the work that I sort of my personal journey and the work that I had done, the career maybe I had built in community sort of immediately began to speak to this spiritual system that Lorne was created. And so out of that came this theoretical framework that we're, you know, getting ready to dig into a little bit more.
Wonderful. So for our readers who might not be familiar, Octavia Butler has been sort of heralded as the queen of Afrofuturism, one of the first writers to really write the future. And a lot of people will call her a prophet, right? And she was very clear, I'm not a prophet, I have these ideas, and when you write them down, they tend to come to life, right?
Right.
So thinking of our fiction writers being what Adrienne Marie Brown calls visionary fiction, right?
Yes.
So creating a vision for the future. And so
Parable of the Sower follows the teenage Lauren Olumina through her life of developing a religion, then developing a following as they are trying to survive what feels like Armageddon, what feels like critical and imminent destruction and death, right? Mm-hmm. The dystopian future that is California.
Right.
And so when you sit down with Parable of the Sower, which it is, correct me if I'm wrong, it is set in 2024, right?
In 2024, isn't that something?
Right. Isn't that something?
Yeah.
So when you sit down with Parable of the Sower and you are reading through this dystopian California, this dystopian United States, and you are really thinking about what our country, what our globe is experiencing right now.
Mm-hmm.
There are terrifying moments. And so, number one, I want to applaud you for finding the beauty in this text and finding the answers to move forward. And then two, I want to talk about how your theory then really does push us to think about ways that we can continue to coexist despite what feels like a dystopian America that is not fictitious, that is our real life. So share with our audience, what are the tenets of revolutionary masculinity and what's its utility in terms of helping us survive through this moment?
Sure. And I appreciate your appreciation. and you know, Butler was very clear also in when she discussed us creating the future, she was also very clear that, you know, human beings can be smart, right? We can look at the past, we can look at the present and have an idea about what the future could look like, right? These are very similar ideas to what, the West African principle of Sankofa, right? You go back and fetch it, right? We can look at the past and get a notion of the future. And so again, in engaging this text and looking through this, this spiritual system, again, as a larger spiritual framework, but also as a very specific lesson to folks who intend to build and expand their masculine representations. I gleaned out of Earthseed this religion, 6 tenets, and those tenets are anti-establishmentism, a collectivism, self-reflexivity, intentional action, flexibility, and an anti-hegemonic masculine performance. And so essentially what I'm saying is in that Earthseed, I saw these sort of 6 common threads that Earthseed was in conversation with gender. And I kind of read that into it. Right. and so those lessons that in that journey, my journey in manhood kind of came through in these Earthseed lessons.
You know, I want to think through this idea of you reading into gender versus not reading into gender. I also want to come back to all these tenets and really dig into each one and think through them. But before we do that, I don't think you are wrong to read into gender when, in fact, Lauren literally plays with gender as a tactic of survival.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you think about, you know, her character choosing to dress masculine and present more masculine in order to gain respect on the road, right? On this road, traveling from her community north. That's a
means of survival.
Uh-huh. That is a very clear,
yeah,
intentional choice in order to survive. And so I think we can read into this sort of gender formation as a site of futurity, as a site of revolution, as a site of gender expansiveness. And some might argue, well, she wasn't trying to be masculine because she feels different in her body. So that doesn't count. But I think there is an argument to be made that not everybody chooses gender expansive identity because they don't feel at home in their bodies.
Right.
Right. Sometimes it's, I don't feel at home in this nation.
Sure.
And I want to express and perform myself in ways that make sense to me. Mm-hmm. Right.
Absolutely.
So I don't think you're wrong to read into Octavia Butler's conception of gender as a site for survival and revolution. And I think we see evidence of that in multiple books of hers, right? The way that she sort of F's with gender. So I just wanted to throw that out there. I think you're spot on.
Yeah, and thank you. Thank you for pulling that out. Also, I would also say that, you know, our notions of gender are cultural and they're temporal, right? So, you know, in every society, it's not like gender looks the same in every society across the world,
right,
at all times forever in human existence, right? So I would not dream of saying that gender or masculinity only looks like these things right now.
Mm-hmm.
And again, just in my interactions with the world, I have learned and have found that engaging with the world and performing my masculinity and performing my brand of masculinity, it helps me when incorporating some of these other sort of, again, more revolutionary tenets. And so that's, I think that's important to mention too, right? That gender is not fixed. It is temporal and it is also cultural.
Absolutely. And I think there's a space in your work where you clearly say this idea, this theory of revolutionary masculinity is not for people who identify as men based on biological sex, right? That it is, that gender is something that anyone can tap into and express across, beyond, within, around the spectrum.
Sure.
It's for boys with an I, it's for boys with a Y, but it's also for women and femmes who play with gender too, right? And so I appreciate that naming and that inclusivity.
Mm-hmm.
I think in our time, even in gender expansive communities, and I might get in trouble for saying this, but we police each other just as much as cis folks police us. and there is a need to stop policing gender, period. Right?
Sure.
Right? Who has access to what, who can perform what, who can be what,
yeah,
should not be dictated by the masses. It should be dictated by the person who lives and breathes in that body.
Sure. And to forthrightly critique that policing as very often an outgrowth of the sort of oppressive society we live in, right? This idea that everything can be put in a box, everything can be put in a binary. It's like we're living the self-fulfilling prophecy that we're trying to avoid. Right. And so I find myself doing a lot of critiquing of Black men, in particular cis Black men, who subscribe to a very narrow, rigid notion of masculinity. This is just another branch on that tree of both critique, mm-hmm, and presenting possibility, as well as folks of other genders who assume masculinity, but assume that it is only these very rigid, you know, narrow,
right,
expressions, right?
Right. So in order to perform masculinity, I must be aggressive. I must be loud. I must be overbearing.
Exactly.
I must embrace this sort of toxic notion of things.
And dominant. Right.
And right. See evidence of this in some of my research when I have talked to trans masculine folks. There's a very clear, you know, line of thinking where, or a sort of a line of being where I see folks who are saying, as I was transitioning, I started off with these really toxic notions of who I had to become.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until I really sat with myself that I realized I am perpetuating a harmful style of gender expression that I need to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And it becomes this moment. And so I think the tenets in revolutionary masculinity really create kind of a rubric, a place for people to find themselves and question themselves and grow into people who are creating the conditions for liberation, are creating the conditions for communal determination and love, mm-hmm. are creating the conditions for us to coexist. So let's get into it. Anti-establishment. Let's talk about what that means and how that shows up as a gendered body.
Okay. So anti-establishmentism is, it essentially, it looks like, and because of the world in which we live, many of the establishments and the institutions in which we are maybe forced to engage or that at least hold sway in our lives are hegemonic, oppressive, because they are founded and exercised on white supremacy, right? Which at its core is patriarchal and, of course, white centering and all that kind of stuff. And so, you know, the anti-establishment threat of this revolutionary masculinity directly confronts troubles, critiques, and you know, really kind of fights through these establishmentarist notions of society, right? And so we find that in Lauren's meditations in her journal, she writes about again fighting against those notions, and in counteracting what Ralph Ellison called a boomerang of history, or rather, you know, where history comes back, an oppressive history comes back to bite again and again and again, right? So there's this sort of anti-government thread, a more specific anti-government thread in anti-establishmentism. There is an anti-religious fundamentalist thread within the anti-establishment trunk of this tree, in which Earthseed directly decries, you know, these, well, really one of the fundamentalist notions that God or the supreme being is wholly male and lords over all people, this white man in the sky that lords over all of our actions, right?
And it was meant to be feared.
And was meant to be feared, exactly, right? And so in direct troubling of that idea, one of the very first verses in Earthseed is God is change. God is not this perpetual white man again lording over the sky. It is the unstoppable power of change. Unstoppable, but possibly wieldable, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. So that idea of using God and using change to create the conditions within which we want to live, learn, play, and thrive.
Yes. Being able to harness, you know, this supreme power, not being able to control this supreme being. And as a matter of fact, one of the quotes from this Earthseed scripture is, God is power, infinite, irresistible, inexorable, indifferent, and yet God is pliable, trickster, teacher, chaos, clay. God exists to be shaped. God is change.
So let's take that and just imagine what that looks like on the body, right? On the black body, on the parent body, mm-hmm. on the adult body. How often do we find ourselves in situations where we try to control the situation instead of controlling our response to it?
Sure.
And trying to be malleable and bend to the situation, right? I'm thinking about parents who have queer and trans kids who are like, I need to control your body, mm-hmm. versus saying, let me learn how to adapt to my child's life and lifestyle so that I can be a supportive parent, right?
Yeah. And you can only be this.
Right. You have to be this, right? So shifting away from controlling and fear-based parenting to adaptable, flexible, supportive parenting, which takes us to our next tenet on flexibility. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, flexibility. And just to mention another thread in anti-establishmentism is the anti-binary, which is, you know, very central to our conversation today, in which we see Lauren, you know, again, troubling and playing with the notions of gender in the novel. But yes, and so moving forward, again, even the last quote that I discussed was flexibility, where we talk about how God has changed, God is pliable, trickster, but also able to be shaped. So an active force, but also a force that can be manipulated. And I'm saying manipulation in a very general and a neutral sense of the word. So with flexibility, Lauren writes that a prodigy is at its essence adaptability, a persistent positive obsession. Without persistence, what remains is an enthusiasm for the moment. Without adaptability, what remains may be channeled into destructive fanaticism. So again, all the while, we're talking about this ubiquitous power, but it is not a power that just forces and tramples on existence, on creation. It is a power that can be shaped. But if it is shaped in a way that is unethical, if you will, then it can be, again, channeled into destructive fanaticism, right? But again, all through the text, Lauren discusses, and that is a fundamental principle of this God or this supreme being that Lauren writes, in that God is change. All that you touch, it changes. All that you touch changes you. It's all through the text. And as a matter of fact, Lauren's name, and it, you know, we're talking about brilliant authors, you know, Octavia Butler is in our shortlist, right? Because Lauren Olamina's middle name is Oya, Lauren Oya Olamina. And Oya, for those who are unaware, Oya is a Yoruba deity, that is described as the power of change and rather sudden change. And so even within, you know, there are layers and layers to this lesson about flexibility and change, even within the name of our protagonist.
So I think one of the takeaways for me in terms of this idea of flexibility is really, how do we show up pliable? Because you never know who, what, where, how you're going to experience the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
And by making ourselves pliable, we make ourselves more resilient, but also more capable of responding in a situation that we might not be familiar with, right? We can pivot.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciate this idea of flexibility almost being linked to a verb, like how we move. And I think that really segues beautifully into the next tenet, right? Intentional action. How are we moving as a people, and where are we placing our intentions? I know we talk a lot in social movement spaces that impact is more important than intention. But when you are thinking about an action beforehand, I think intention is much more important than potential impact, right? How are we moving with intention so that our impacts can land the way we need them to, right? Versus mm-hmm. starting from a place of, let's just focus on impact. So yeah, let's talk about that intentional action.
Right. So thank you. And so in the novel, you know, the land, the setting is this 2020s dystopian American landscape that is rife with, you know, disease and drug addiction and, you know, abuse and violence of all kinds. And we get a sense from the writing that this world has been created by these sort of unintentional, or these wild, aggressive and really uncollective and immature expressions of patriarchy, capitalism of the past leading up to the present. Right. So intentional action becomes really important in this, you know, textual moment. Because there's chaos abound, right? Chaos is really ruling the landscape. And so in this way, meeting chaos with chaos does not seem to be the way to go, right? And so in approaching this very dangerous, very restrictive and discriminatory present in the text, with taking time, you know, not being inactive, not being inactive, but taking time to recognize, the conditions and recognize the goal, the main characters or this group of refugees is able to make their way through this very chaotic landscape, into their goal of, you know, relative safety, and a relative liberatory safety. Right. And so if we put that against our lived and material experiences, you know, we meet with sort of this same thing. Some of us, some readers might argue that the landscape of Parable of the Sower is not so different than our current reality. Right. You know, some people would discuss the similarities between just the amount of crime and, you know, crime that affects community in negative ways, you know, the poverty that is rife throughout our communities, right? The patriarchy that has clearly created the, you know, our thoughts about how we interact with each other, but also really, they have infused themselves. People have infused patriarchy and capitalism and hegemony into the institutions that hold sway over our lives. And so with intentional action, the masculine, the masculinity that we decide to perform, we decide to assume, if we were to use that masculinity in the prescribed sort of Western ways, you know, we could allow ourselves to be these very wild and aggressive man beasts, right? Or what, you know, man beasts or male beasts, right? But with intentional action, the idea is to use these sort of Western ideas of male strength, male protection, activity, forward movement, but in intentional ways, in ways that are well thought, that are well considered, and even collective, which gets into our next tenet. Ways in which elevate the needs of community, the needs of the many over, you know, singular needs or singular desires.
You know, I think about the ways that people force their bodies onto others and how this notion of collectivism eliminates that as a possibility, right? Because if our bodies are connected in such a way where everything I do impacts you and vice versa, mm-hmm. if I am always thinking of the collective, am I creating space for harm?
Mm-hmm.
Am I doing harm if that collective is always at the front of my mind, right? So this thing that I'm doing, if I'm thinking again with intention, if I do this, how does it impact the collective? How does that shift how humans just interact? That's a fundamental shift mm-hmm. in human interaction, right? When we step out of individualism and into collectivism.
Sure. So some of the radical or revolutionary social justice and Black power movements and groups from the 60s and 70s and beyond, they embraced this quote in Kiswahili that says "Hofu ni kwenu," or "My fear is for you." And so that really says, right, if I'm thinking about you and you thinking about me, if everybody is hofu ni kwenu, and then everybody is taken care of, right? If my concern is that you all right and your concern is that I'm all right, then we all gonna be cool. And so that kind of gets to the heart of this collectivism that is a part of Earthseed and a part of this revolutionary masculine rubric. In that, again, the landscape is full of these examples of folks taking these very selfish and aggressive actions. Lauren's younger brother, next brother, his name is Keith. And he becomes sort of this representation of this hyper masculine and really immature expression of masculinity. He strikes out. He is, you know, really mean and sort of their familial environment. Even though the idea in the community is that we all stick together, we take care of ourselves. We also mind the wall that is protecting us from the outside. He strikes out and without telling anyone, he's like 12 or 13 or something like that. He strikes out on his own on these sort of jaunts into this really dangerous landscape, comes back injured, comes back noticeably psychologically changed, right? When he comes back, the more he comes back, he goes out and comes back, the worse he becomes to Lauren and the rest of the community members. And so you see this sort of anti-collectivism at work in this character. And so Lauren, in writing Earthseed, you know, critiques that idea of anti-collectivism, of aggression and selfishness, and really elevates the ideas that in shaping and using this supreme force, doing so in a way that supports the collective, that edifies our collective existence, is a way to ensure our survival and a way to ensure that we all thrive. And so again, in my journey, I have learned that in learning from family, our parents teach us, you know, sometimes you got to think about other people, right? In community, in community organizing, right? We're not doing this for ourselves. And if we are, we're kind of doing it wrong, right? What do they say? If you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, you go together, right? And so we find in social justice and radical and revolutionary freedom movements across the timescape, right? That this collective action is really at the core. This collective freedom and communal liberation is at the core of action. And so again, Butler kind of harnesses those ideas and pulls them into Earthseed for us to engage and enjoy and incorporate.
So the last tenet we can talk about then is self-reflexivity, which for me is one of the most important tenets, because it really pushes this idea of self-awareness and understanding how the way we show up impacts the communities that we're a part of. So talk to us about self-reflexivity.
Yeah, so in the tenet of self-reflexivity comes through in Earthseed, and in particular, one quote where Lauren writes, "To get along with God, consider the consequences of your behavior." And so again, this is not a linear process, right? These are all of these tenets are working together. They're fluid and sometimes they overlap, right? If we're considering how our expression and how our actions are affecting the world around us and affecting ourselves, we can find a pathway or carve a pathway to more healthy behavior. And I've sort of, even in my own, again, in my journey of self-discovery, I have found myself at times doing or acting or responding rather than feeling. And so I figured when that came through in the text, you know, I figured it had to be included, you know, to recognize, to be, first of all, to be able to feel oneself is at the core of many spiritual practices across our earth, you know, across the earth, right? To be able to focus on one specific thing, like our breathing, right? Or how we are feeling and responding in a situation, to be able to feel that. And then from there, be able to feel everything around us. And that ability to feel, that ability to be reflexive in one's environment, helps us to be, to helps us to have recognition of the effect that we're having on that environment. And if we, you know, embrace, you know, an ethic that is collective, we can recognize those behaviors that are working, that help to elevate and help to expand and grow and create positive change in our environments. So we can also look at those ideas, those behaviors that are really diminishing who we are, that are help, that make us feel bad, that make other folks feel bad, that reduce the environment, that, you know, that cause climate change, or that, you know, that cause inequity, you know, all of those kinds of things. And so again, that self-reflexivity I felt was very important to mention in this text as part of a rubric for revolutionary masculinity.
Absolutely. I really appreciate this sort of leaning into what is required of us as stewards of community, mm-hmm. in our gendered expression, and is shifting away from how messed up masculinity is, right? We've got decades of scholarship on toxic masculinity, hegemonic masculinity, but what we don't have is a rubric on how to move forward as good stewards of our gender expression in ways that serve the collective. So I really want to thank you for your work. Thank you for how you show up in community. I'm sure there are folks who are really eager to learn more about your work. Can you share any next steps? Are you looking forward to maybe publishing this as a book? Where can we find out more about your work?
Sure. So I have submitted proposal for approval with the Critical Futures, with the Critical Futures series, as you know, not a people know. And I'm looking forward to fleshing out this revolutionary masculinity rubric, and also mapping it on to characters in the novel, and also expanding into Parable of the Talents. If there are other tenants, I'm looking forward to finding them, because this is a study. I'm not necessarily putting my own thoughts onto the work and making that stick. I'm trying to figure out what the text is telling. So that, you know, look forward to my book coming out on the Critical Futures series. And so I'm also working on an article, that is an autoethnography about my interactions with working with the earth. And I'm sort of signifying on bell hooks's Touching the Earth in a way that discusses my journey through, you know, through grief, and my journey through, you know, manhood and grief and all of these joys and victories of life, and how working, you know, with the earth, in horticulture therapy, in farming, urban farming, and, you know, farming with my, in memories of farming with my parents and my grandparents, helped to, you know, signal, help to sort of fix those memories in my mind, and help, you know, help me as a sort of therapy. And so I'll be discussing some of, you know, I'll be sort of buttressing that conversation with some of these tenants as well. So yeah, those are just a couple of things.
Wonderful. Well, we look forward to all of the things that are to come out of this theory. It is fruitful. It will blossom. And I think it's going to help change the world. So thank you so much for joining us on the Critical Futures podcast to discuss the future of masculinity. And I look forward to what comes next.
I'm looking forward to, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Critical Futures podcast. If you're feeling inspired and looking for more resources, please check out www.ihje.org/podcast for show notes and links to resources and to subscribe.